Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, the unscripted show that celebrates unsung heroes, myth busts historical lies, and rediscovers the forgotten stories that changed our world. I'm your host, Scott Rank. We might not know much about the presidents of more than 100 or 150 years ago, but we can at least respect their facial hair. Consider the huge mutton chops of Martin Van Buren or the enormous beard of Rutherford B. Hayes that if he had a man bun would fit right in New York or Tacoma. One president that stood out to me for his facial hair was Chester A. Arthur for his mutton chop sideburns. But for me, as somebody who studies history professionally, I didn't know that much about Chester A. Arthur. Most people don't either. They consider him an obscure president who basically fell into the presidency because Garfield unexpectedly died. I'm talking in this episode with Scott Greenberger, who's the author of The Unexpected President, The Life and Times of Chester A. Arthur. Arthur really did fall into the presidency. He had almost no political experience when he was selected to be vice president. The only reason he was is because before that time, Arthur was at the New York Customs House. It was a really greedy form of extortion during the time of the machine political age when he was collector of the New York Customs House. It was the largest single federal office in the nation and a place where you would hand out jobs and you would skim off any sort of imports that were coming into America. Arthur was basically a good old boy in the New York political machine system. And the reason he was chosen as vice president was because Garfield thought he needed someone on his ticket who would please the machine boss Roscoe Conkling to secure help in winning New York. Basically considered a flunky. Well, to everybody's surprise, President Garfield was shot in 1881, and now this flunky was president of the United States. But despite everyone having no expectation of him, the office really did change the man. He, who was a symbol of party corruption, enacted important civil reforms so that now, in order to have a government job, you had to pass a merit test. He expanded American power during the Gilded Age. He reformed the U.S. Navy. And he made it possible for America to have a government that people could trust during the Progressive Era when Teddy Roosevelt wanted to expand it, but also to grow America's power. So by the time of the Spanish-American War in 1898, it was ready to emerge on the international scene as a country that people had to seriously contend with. Well, people really didn't know what Arthur was capable of. And Scott gives all sorts of fascinating information about a president that most of us think we don't have any reason to know anything about beside his famous sideburns. Enjoyed this discussion about our forgotten 21st president, Chester A. Arthur, and my discussion with Scott Greenberger. Scott, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, Chester A. Arthur is an interesting president. Americans would recognize the name, but they don't know much about him. For myself, I'm not an American historian by training, but I have an above average knowledge. And I have very limited understanding of him, his background, his short presidency. Why do Americans know so little about Chester A. Arthur? And do you think this is fair or unfair?
Well, I think there are a couple reasons why Americans know relatively little about him. The first one is that he was president during a period that's a little foggy in the minds of most Americans. I think that many of us in school spend a lot of time, of course, justifiably so, learning about the Civil War and then a little bit about Reconstruction. And then I think you pretty quickly fast forward to Teddy Roosevelt and the progressives and then Woodrow Wilson and World War One. So I think that period of the late 1870s, 1880s gets short shrift. But I think it's a fascinating and important period. This is the what Mark Twain famously called the Gilded Age. And it's really the period of American history where you can see the America that we know today starting to take shape. So you have, for the first time, sort of ultra wealthy individuals. This is the first time when Americans heard the term millionaire. You have the formation of large corporations, trusts that Teddy Roosevelt would later bust. So it's a very interesting time period. So I think that's one reason people don't know much about Arthur, is that he and the other presidents of that time are sort of don't get a lot of attention in history classes, because that period doesn't get a lot of attention. I think the other reason, though, which is particular to Arthur, is that shortly before he died, he ordered most of his papers to be burned, and that was because he was ashamed of the person he had been and the politician he had been before he became president. And therefore, there's not a lot for historians to look at. And I think that has contributed to the fact that he is rather obscure. But I think he has a fascinating story, and it's a story that's incredibly surprising, and also I think has particular resonance today because he has quite a bit in common with Donald Trump, actually.
Yeah, I'm really fascinated by the picture you paint of the Gilded Age and politicians like him, because while we rightfully complain about corruption today, it's just mind-boggling what it was like back then. Before we get into his pre-presidential political life, could you paint a picture of what politics was like during this era, the late 19th century, the party bosses and the party machines and cities and states and all of that, and how a system like that could work?
Well, sure. This was the era of, as you say, machine politics. So in a state like New York, the Republican Party, the Republican machine, dominated the state political scene, and it perpetuated its power through what was called the spoil system. So people who were loyal to the party, who helped the party, were rewarded with jobs. And this was true of city jobs, state jobs, but also federal jobs that were happened to be located in New York. So instead of people being hired based on their qualifications or their experience, their education, people were hired for these jobs based on their political loyalty, their party loyalty. And in fact, once they were in those jobs, they were expected more than expected, they were required to make campaign contributions to the party so the party could stay in power. So this is the first, and as I noted, it's also a period where you have, for the first time in American history, the rise of very wealthy individuals and large corporations that had a keen interest in what government was doing then as now. There was a lot that government was involved in that had a direct impact on their financial fortunes. So, for example, this is the period of time when you have the railroad, construction of railroads, and the government had a lot to do with deciding where the railroads would go, making sure that rules and permitting that needed to be done and land that needed to be procured. And so this is really the period of time where we see for the first time the influence of big money in politics and this kind of combination of high finance and big corporations and politics and sort of this unholy relationship between them.
Right. This is going on all over the place, and especially in New York State, which is where Arthur enters the picture. But from what I know of earlier presidents like Martin Van Buren, he was also a New Yorker, and I think he had his own early 19th century version of a machine. And then in the New York City politics, you have Boss Tweed later on. Is there something about New York, the state, that breeds all of this political corruption in this period? What's going on in New York?
Well, as you note, there were machines in other states, but this was prevalent in New York, I think, for a few reasons. One, New York then, as now, New York City, was really the financial center of the country, the most important city in the country. And so there was just a lot of money kind of sloshing around in New York. This was particularly the case a little later after Van Buren with Arthur and the Republican boss of his era, Roscoe Conkling, and with Boss Tweed. New York already in the 1870s had become a real magnet for immigrants, and Boss Tweed in particular saw these immigrants coming into the country as a flooding into the country as a real political advantage. If you could win the support of these people, you were going to do quite well in elections. And there was these people needed a lot of help. Housing was scarce, and they arrived unfamiliar with the language. And the Boss Tweed in particular used this to his advantage by helping the immigrants to find housing, to find jobs, and thereby winning their political support. And that helped them to build the machine. So I think that was part of what was going on in New York as well. The immigrants flooding in, and just the fact that there was a tremendous amount of money. And of course, you know, Wall Street high finance was based in New York. So there were several factors contributing to that.
Yeah, kind of an unofficial safety net. And if the government or the state or whatever won't take care of them, then someone will come in and fill the vacuum. Definitely.
That's right. And the city and state were not taking care of them. It was, we had much small, you know, we didn't have welfare programs or the kinds of the kind of safety net that existed, starting from FDR on. I mean, that was unheard of then. So people really did need help.
Right. I'm based here in Kansas City, and I had a guest who talked about Tom Pendergast, who ran his own city machine in the 20s. And he also built his empire on Irish immigrants, Latino immigrants, and others, too. So provided those social services, like you mentioned. Well, let's see in this scenario that we've described here where Arthur enters the picture. So what's his background and what gets him into this political universe?
Okay, so Arthur was born in Vermont in 1829, and his father was a preacher and who happened to be an outspoken and vehement abolitionist, and was so outspoken in his views that the family he alienated multiple congregations and ended up sort of taking his family from place to place in Vermont and then upstate New York. Arthur went to Union College in Schenectady and graduated. After graduation, decided that he wanted to be a lawyer, and that if he really wanted to succeed in life and fulfill his ambitions, the place to do that was New York City. So he, shortly after studying the law, joined after college, came to New York City and joined the law firm of an abolitionist a friend of his. And during this period, actually was involved in a very important case, which had largely been forgotten. But he was the lawyer who won the case that ended up desegregating New York City's streetcars. This decision was considered to be so momentous that for years afterward, the African-American community in New York City celebrated the anniversary of the verdict. So very prominent case and a very important case. And then when the Civil War arrived, he had already determined that if he really wanted to make his way in New York as a lawyer, that politics was going to be a promising route for him to rise in life. And so he, through a series of connections, ended up serving on a sort of a ceremonial honor guard that accompanied the governor of New York, a guy named Edwin Morgan, who was Arthur's first political patron. And so this was a ceremonial job, but when the Civil War started, it very quickly became serious because Lincoln asked the states the states had a tremendous responsibility to raise their own troops. And Arthur was tasked with this job for New York State and ended up becoming quartermaster of the Union Army in New York City, responsible for housing and equipping the huge numbers of troops that New York was supplying to the Union Army. And by all accounts, he did this job very well and was very honest and served with integrity. And this was certainly an opportunity that he could have enriched himself if he wanted to. And many, many other people used the Civil War and these kinds of military contracts to enrich themselves. But he did not, served honorably. When Morgan was defeated as governor, though, Arthur lost his job and decided that at this point he was married, decided that he did want to use his knowledge of the military contracts and his connections to make some money. This is not unfamiliar to how things work today in Washington or other places where people kind of cash out after they've done their public service. So he ends up and he's married at this point and wants to make money, and his wife has some expensive tastes and he does as well. And so this is the period after the Civil War where he does start to kind of get involved with the machine, and he realizes that this is the way things are done. If you want to be involved in politics in New York during this era, you are a machine politician if you want to rise in the machine. And after a period of time, he ended up rising through the ranks and becoming a top lieutenant to the Republican boss of the period. His name was Roscoe Conkling. And Conkling is a fascinating figure, but he and was extremely eloquent and handsome and very interesting guy. But he was a politician who didn't really like people so much. Arthur loved people. And so he was the guy, the sort of the backslapping guy who kept the machine running. He loved to stay up late eating and drinking and smoking cigars with his machine buddies. So he was really perfect for this role. And through Conkling's influence, President Grant appointed Arthur to be collector of the New York Custom House, which was the largest federal office in the country. And as I mentioned earlier, it was considered the prerogative of the local state senators to fill the jobs there. And so Grant appointed Arthur, and this was the most important job for the machine because these were hundreds of jobs that the Republicans could give out to loyal supporters. And then once they were in those positions to collect campaign contributions from them. So Arthur was a great success in this job, made a lot of money, both legitimately and illegitimately, because he actually was, as collector, entitled to take a cut from all of the penalties that people who were importing goods and failed to pay the appropriate duties had to pay in penalties. He took a cut of that, given his position. And he also, there were other ways, given the amount of money involved there in his position, to enrich himself, and he took advantage of those opportunities. In 1878, and by this time, Grant was gone, and he'd been succeeded by Rutherford B. Hayes, who was a guy who wanted to reform machine politics and push back against this kind of the reigning machine bosses of the time, fired Arthur from the Custom House. And it seemed like Arthur's political career was over. Yeah, he had enriched himself and he'd risen to prominence in the machine, but now he didn't really, he didn't have a public job. He went back to being a lawyer. He still helped Conkling and actually was, did have a job connected to Boss Tweed. We mentioned that earlier as well. So there he was not destitute by any means, but it did seem like his political career might be over. And then shockingly, in 1880, when the Republicans gathered in Chicago to choose a nominee for president, Conkling and the machine politicians in the party wanted Grant to come back for an unprecedented third term, because Hayes had promised just to serve a single term. So the Republicans, there was no incumbent, and Conkling and his supporters and other machine politicians around the country wanted Grant to return. Others, more reform-minded Republicans, did not want Grant. And the convention was deadlocked, ballot after ballot after ballot, I think a total of 36 ballots, and they still could not agree on a candidate. And then a dark horse candidate emerged, Congressman James Garfield. He ended up being the compromise choice. The Republicans knew, however, that the fact that Grant had not been renominated was galling to Conkling, and they needed Conkling's support in order to win the election, because New York was the most populous state in the Union. They didn't think they could win in the fall without Conkling's help in New York. And so to placate Conkling, they decided that what they would do would be to give the vice presidential spot to one of his flunkies, one of his cronies, and they chose Arthur. They figured that, well, the vice president doesn't do much anyway. Garfield is young and vigorous. Arthur or somebody like him can do less damage in that spot than he might do in many other jobs. So let's just give the job to Arthur. So Arthur went from being the fired custom house collector to suddenly on a national ticket. And the Republicans did win in November. And Arthur was vice president of the United States.
That's what's so interesting, because this guy, this kind of backslapping, good old boy, corrupt machine politician, you'd never expect to be part of civil service reform. And I'd like to dig in a little bit into what his day-to-day life looked like at the customs house, because it'd be like today if there's a guy who's running the Port Authority where a lot of goods come into the U.S., but he's taking 1 or 2% off of everything. And I don't know how it worked.
That's
for,
yeah.
I don't know how it worked for Garfield, but he made a lot of, or I'm sorry, not Garfield, Arthur. He made a lot of money doing this. I think more than the president. So could you walk me through what would a day look like for him in the customs house? A shipment comes in from wherever. And how does that work out? How does the corrupt nature of party politics work into all this? Could you walk me through that?
Sure. Well, first of all, I should say that Arthur didn't work particularly hard. He liked to, as I mentioned, he liked to stay up late at night drinking and smoking and eating with the machine guys. And so he very often didn't arrive at the custom house till late in the morning or early in the afternoon. And his main job there was to make sure that the custom house was working for the machine. So he made sure that people who loyalists who should be rewarded with jobs were rewarded with jobs. He made sure that when the Republicans, when it was campaign season, that the employees of the Custom House contributed. And he actually did get along well with the most of the importers and other businessmen who had business with the Custom House. As I mentioned, he was a guy, he was sort of a backslapping good old boy, and they liked him. There also were, though, several cases where, let's just say the inspectors for the Custom House were considered to be a little overzealous in levying fines, and in some cases levied fines that were not justified. And as you mentioned, Arthur and other officers of the Custom House had an incentive to be vigorous or even overzealous, because they got a cut of whatever penalties were paid.
So if it were something absurd, just a fraction off of whatever the allotment was, like you can only import this amount or that amount, they'd always come down with the hammer to make sure they could get their cut?
Yes, yes, that's exactly right. But he was, he managed to sort of walk that line, though. There wasn't any sort of, great, you know, hue and cry of protest from, importers. He was very skilled politically in that way. So sort of socially, he had a very high social IQ. And he wasn't, you know, he was a lawyer, and he did have some relevant knowledge in terms of the businesses that were involved with the Custom House and his day-to-day responsibilities. So he did quite well there. Certainly, he did quite well personally, but also from Conkling's perspective, he was terrific.
Okay, so this is where he comes from. He's adept at knowing how to navigate the law and sort of cover himself so he doesn't go too far out there. And then through being the right person at the right place at the right time to please the right people, ends up vice president. What is the roadway from him being this vice president that no one really knew or cared about as a seat warmer to suddenly he's the president? What's that path?
Well, it's incredible, because even as vice president, so the new president, Garfield, like his predecessor, Hayes, was determined or at least talked about, wanting to reform the spoil system to attack the machines. So Arthur is vice president, and I should tell one little anecdote to give people a sense of just how strange this was, that Garfield was president and Arthur was vice president. So after Garfield became president, he appointed a new collector of the Custom House, who was not an ally of Conkling's, even though the Custom House was in New York and it was considered to be the home senator's prerogative to choose that person. And so Conkling and the other New York senator resigned to protest this decision, figuring that the New York legislature would very quickly re-elect them to those positions. So this is before the direct election of senators. And instead, the legislature balked. And Arthur, even though he was Garfield's vice president, went to Albany and tried to do what he could to get Conkling re-elected in direct defiance of what Garfield was doing. So this was a vice president of the United States working at cross purposes with the president. And so when Garfield was shot in a railroad station in Washington in July of 1881, many people, and this was expressed in many newspapers, suspected that Arthur and Conkling had something to do with it, because there was this rift in the Republican Party and they were on the opposite side of Garfield. And so Arthur was mortified, as you might imagine, by the suggestion that he had something to do with the assassination of Garfield, or the shooting of Garfield. They were at odds politically, but he certainly didn't want to see him dead. So after being shot, though, Garfield lingered throughout the summer of 1881. He did not die immediately. And this was a very difficult period for Arthur. Not only were some people convinced that he'd had something to do with the shooting, but the consensus expressed in all the newspapers was that he was totally unfit for office, unqualified, corrupt, and people were horrified at the idea that this guy, this party hack, would be president of the United States. And so when Garfield, shortly before Garfield finally succumbed to his wounds at the end of that summer, Arthur got a letter from a mysterious young woman, a young New Yorker named Julia Sand, who clearly had been following his career and knew a lot about politics. But this was a period where women weren't allowed to vote, much less run for office or really be involved, but she was what we would call now a political junkie, and she wrote in this extraordinary letter urging him to, in essence, to be a better person, to return to the kind of idealistic person he had been as a young lawyer when he had desegregated the New York City streetcars. And I think that that letter, which was the first of two dozen that she would write to him over the next couple of years, combined with the horror at at Garfield's suffering, because he really was in agony for a good part of that summer, just lingering, and these accusations that somehow Arthur had something to do with the shooting, all of this really led to a dramatic transformation in Arthur.
Right. I'm interested in that because you've mentioned some of the things he's done with civil service reform, and I want to dig into that a lot more. But for somebody who's been part of the machine for I don't know how many years at this point, he was in it for 7 years and then however many years before that, to have that sudden switch be flipped like that, do you see it being this really dramatic reversal, or is it something that he has to build to over a period of time in order to turn into this reformer that you describe him as?
I don't think it took much time, because when you think about what he was doing on Conkling's behalf, even while he was vice president, so Garfield took office in March. This is when presidents were inaugurated in March, and he was shot in July. And during that period, or a good chunk of that period, Arthur was working on behalf of Conkling and against Garfield. So at that point, he is still a machine politician, even as vice president of the United States. But then during that summer, the period between the shooting of Garfield and when he finally dies at the end of that summer, I think that's when he undergoes this transformation. I think it was a combination of the factors that I mentioned, but it really was an abrupt transformation. It was apparent almost immediately when he became president, because during his in his first annual message to Congress, which is what we would now call the State of the Union address, although then it was just written, not a speech, he called for civil service reform, and people were shocked because this was a guy who was the epitome of a machine politician, a product of the spoil system himself. I mean, his whole political career had been built on this system, and yet here he is calling for reform and saying, as Garfield and certainly Hayes had before him, that it was time to award federal jobs on the basis of people's qualifications and experience and not on their political leanings. So people were shocked, and in fact, Congress really wasn't ready, because they also benefited from this system in various ways. They weren't ready to do anything about it, and in large part, this appeal by Arthur was ignored. But after the elections, the midterm elections in 1882, where the Republicans suffered pretty heavy losses across the country, and these results were widely interpreted to be a rebuke to machine politics, Arthur, again, in his second annual message, called for civil service reform again and an end to the sort of mandatory campaign contributions that he had so enthusiastically collected when he was collector of the Custom House. And this time, Congress was ready to follow his lead, and they did pass civil service reform. Now, even at this point, many reformers in the party said, well, okay, Arthur is signing this bill, but there's plenty he can do as president to kind of make sure that it has no teeth, to make sure that it's not really implemented. But he surprised everybody and faithfully and vigorously implemented this law. So it was really, he really had changed.
How did he do this? Because I'm imagining there's Arthur himself, but then all of the representatives and senators he need to get on board to support civil service reform. I could see machine bosses aggressively bullying politicians to make sure they don't support it. When during the Gilded Age, individual private businessmen can be far more wealthy than the U.S. government, have far more power. There are maybe more illegitimate means to get what you want in this time. What sort of opposition did Arthur have to overcome in order to pass this? And not only him, but the politicians who supported this reform.
Well, I think a lot of the people on Capitol Hill in Congress really were scared by the 1882 elections. It really did appear that people had finally had enough, and I think that the assassination of Garfield also was part of this, because Garfield was shot by a guy named Charles Guiteau, who was absolutely insane, yeah. But he also was a disappointed office seeker. He was a guy who thought that by virtue of his contributions, or the work rather, that he had done for the Republicans in 1880, that he was owed a federal job. Now, he was out of his mind, and he thought that he should be ambassador to Austria or France, he was ignored. But this was really what spurred him to attack Garfield in that train station. And when he, when he shot Garfield and was arrested right after, he said, "I'm a stalwart," which was the name of the wing of the party represented by Arthur and Conkling, "and Arthur will be president." So people really did think that, not only were many people fed up with machine politics, they thought that machine politics and the spoil system had now led to the death of an American president, the assassination of an American president. And so I think people really were, that combined with the results in the 1882 elections, convinced people on Capitol Hill, senators and congressmen, representatives, that, we can't really hold back this tide any longer. We need to pass this bill, which was called the Pendleton Act, and had been languishing on Capitol for several years. Perhaps they thought that Arthur, the machine politician in the White House, would sign this bill and then not really implemented, and that they could bow to public pressure without really having to make or having to endure any sort of substantive change. But as I said, Arthur surprised everybody and did vigorously pursue implementation of this law.
Did this law have a dramatic effect right at the beginning, or did it take a while for these changes to really be digested by the government? And I'm guessing, were there ways that people would avoid this kind of, like, there's emancipation of slavery, but then for several decades, there's still institutionalized discrimination like that?
Well, it was a gradual process, but this was the beginning. So under the initial law, only a certain percentage of the federal jobs were covered by the law, but that grew over time, and it did really, it did represent a huge shift. And I think actually that you could make the argument that the progressives, Teddy Roosevelt, everything that came after wouldn't really have been possible without civil service reform, because it's hard to imagine that Americans would have wanted their federal government to take a more active role, and it did assume a more active role in the succeeding decades, if they knew that everybody in a government job was just a hack and a clown. But now that we were starting down this road of actually having civil service exams and rules again on who could be promoted and when, who could be fired, and for what, a ban on these mandatory campaign contributions, people, all of a sudden the government is becoming more legitimate, the federal government. It's no longer just a place where a place that's filled with party hacks and campaign workers and people who don't know what the heck they're doing. Now you have people who really are dedicated to the job, who are civil servants in the truest sense of the word. So I think it was a really important change, and Arthur deserves a lot of credit for starting us down that road.
He was president during an interesting time. This is the 1880s, after the Civil War, but before America's emergence on the global scene in the Spanish-American War in 1898. And I think it was in Rutherford B. Hayes when the first telephone is installed in the White House, and Thomas Edison is inventing away, and there's economic growth. So what were other things that happened during Arthur's administration and other accomplishments that he achieved?
Well, one other big accomplishment, I would say that this is his other major accomplishment, was had to do with the U.S. Navy, because in the years since the Civil War, the Navy had really fallen into disrepair. This was a time when America didn't really see itself as a global power or even a global player or a player on the world stage. And therefore, nobody really thought the U.S. needed a real Navy. At this point, even as the European powers were building steel ships and huge navies, the U.S. was lagging far behind. It had mostly wooden ships. It was very officer heavy because the government as a whole, many of the jobs were just filled by people who had the right connections or the right political loyalties, and not by people who actually had expertise. So it was with that kind of a Navy, it would be very difficult for the United States to assert itself in foreign policy, or even to enforce its economic interests, or to grow its economic interests. And Arthur recognized this and pushed very hard with his Navy secretary to push the Congress to start building modern ships. So I think that was his. And was able to win support for that. And I think that was his other major accomplishment. And that really had an impact, because this, once again, was the beginning of what would be a couple of decades of very impressive progress in the same direction, to the point where when you have Teddy Roosevelt as president, he's sending the Navy around the world in a show of American might and prowess. And that, it's hard to imagine that that would have happened, or that it would have been possible for that to happen at that point without the changes that Arthur started to make during his presidency.
And also, he argued against the Supreme Court striking down the 1875 Civil Rights Act, didn't he?
He did. That's a really interesting point as well. So the Supreme Court, the Civil Rights Act of 1875, passed in the wake of the Civil War, of course. About 100 years, almost 100 years before we came back to this issue, it sought to guarantee the civil rights of African Americans, not just in terms of how they were treated by the government, but how they were treated on public transportation, in restaurants, that kind of thing. And the Supreme Court during Arthur's presidency struck down that law, claiming that it had gone too far, that it wasn't the government's business to tell the private sector what it should do. And what's interesting is that at the time, even progressive Republicans, many progressive Republicans, when I say progressive, I mean on the issue of race, were not surprised that the Supreme Court had struck it down. Many people believed that it was that the Civil Rights Act of 1875 was an overreach, and it was only a matter of time before it was struck down. So you look at the newspaper accounts of the time, and even the papers in New York that were certainly sympathetic, by the standards of the time to African Americans and their struggle for rights, said, well, you know, we're not surprised. It's not such a big deal. It shouldn't really matter. But black leaders, of course, knew better than that. Frederick Douglass gave a speech at the time shortly after that decision, saying, in essence, this is a complete disaster for us, and this is going to be a disaster for us for decades to come. And of course, he was absolutely right. It wasn't until the 1960s that we rectified that. But Arthur did recognize, I think, I mentioned that his father had been a strident abolitionist, and he was pretty progressive on issues of race. And he, unlike most Republicans, thought that the decision was wrong and opposed the decision and urged Congress to pass some other kind of a law that would withstand judicial scrutiny. Now, he didn't push very hard for that, perhaps because he felt that there wasn't much chance of it succeeding, perhaps because he still didn't have a lot of political juice on Capitol Hill, given the fact that he was sort of an accidental president. So he sort of, it seemed like on that issue, he had the right leanings, the right ideas, but didn't push so hard to advance those ideas. But that's an interesting episode in his presidency, I think. So it shows that he was inclined to do the right thing, and it's sort of his heart and his head were in the right place, but he didn't always do the right thing.
Well, he seems to have been pretty effective on the big issues with civil service reform, with military reform, understanding America's place in international politics at this era. But he didn't seek a second term. He didn't run for a second term. Why didn't he do this?
That is a good question. I think there are a few things. First of all, he, as I just mentioned, many people still viewed him as kind of an accidental president. He had alienated his old friends from the machine, Roscoe Conkling and the other, his old buddies from New York thought he was a traitor because he had pushed for civil service reform. And the reformers still didn't completely trust him. They were still wary of this guy who had made his career in machine politics. And so he didn't really have a natural constituency in the Republican Party. So that was part of it. The other thing was that he was secretly suffering from what was then called Bright's disease, which was a kidney ailment. And it actually, during periods of his presidency, it was very difficult for him to do his job. It left him very tired and nauseous. And so he may have also feared that he wouldn't survive a second term. Now, I think when you read the accounts of the time, it seems like he certainly would have welcomed the nomination, but didn't feel like he wanted to push that hard for it. He first of all, he knew he was sick. But also, and this is sort of ironic, he wasn't willing to use all of the political tools, the patronage tools at his disposal as president to win the support of the delegates who were meeting again in Chicago to choose a nominee. And so they ended up not choosing him. So it was interesting. He was not renominated. And yet by the end of his presidency, people's the public's view of him really had been transformed. He was widely praised before he left office, or as he left office, as an honest and effective president who really had risen to the occasion, had surprised everybody. Mark Twain, in fact, who certainly had a lot of fun making fun of politicians, said that he said it was hard to imagine an administration better than Arthur's. And people talked about him as if he was one of the greatest presidents we'd ever had. And yet now he's almost completely forgotten. So I think that's it's just a fascinating story.
Right. We don't know much about him, but at the time they were praising him. And as you mentioned, I think it's in the jacket of your book that people know of him maybe for his mutton chops and his facial hair, which is definitely distinctive. So I would never take that away from Arthur. But he's just a piece of trivia for most people. So you mentioned at the top of this interview that his place in the Gilded Age politics of America can speak to things today in the 21st century. So to tie in these things we've talked about, what do you think Arthur can say to us today?
Well, I think there are a few things. First of all, I mentioned that there are a lot of parallels with our current president. So Arthur was a wealthy New Yorker who had made at least some of his fortune through questionable means. He ended up, his ascension to the presidency was a shock to almost everybody, including him, including people in his party. The expectations for him were low, to put it mildly. I mean, people thought he was corrupt, that he was a clown, that he was unqualified, had very limited experience, just the custom house job. He'd never really been elected to anything except for vice president. And yet, he became a very different president than people expected. So I think, you know, we're 8 months or so into the Trump administration, and it doesn't seem like he is much different from the guy during the campaign. But Arthur is an example of somebody who did change in the presidency, and it's kind of a fascinating counterexample. You know, former President Obama said shortly before the election, and of course he was making this argument in support of Hillary Clinton, he said, you know, he warned people about Donald Trump. He said, the presidency doesn't change people. It magnifies who you are. It doesn't change who you are. And yet Arthur seems to be an exception to that rule, because the presidency and its responsibilities really did change who he was, or at least who he had been for the previous 2 decades or so. And I think the other interesting thing, given all the parallels between the Gilded Age and our own time, because we also are very concerned about the influence of money in politics, and we also are living in a time of amazing new technologies, but technologies that many fear only making a select few very wealthy and not benefiting, and that there's a lot of income inequality, and that many Americans are being left behind. I mean, these are all things that were concerns during Arthur's period, as well as our own period. And it's interesting and sort of hopeful, I think, to see and learn a little bit about how Americans of that time dealt with those problems and did make changes that gave people greater confidence in their government and sort of set us on this path of as I mentioned earlier, a federal government that was empowered to do more to help people. So it makes you wonder, well, where, at what point will we sort of figure out or find the political will to address some of these problems, some of these deficiencies in our current system that many people are so worried about. But it shows you that we've been through this before in a way, and we've figured out ways to improve the system and to move forward.
Well, I like that analysis, because a theme I've tried to hammer on this podcast is that the past has much to teach us, since what we encounter now is almost, well, really never unprecedented. And people in the past who've encountered similar situations and have come out for the better can really speak to us on those things. So thank you for sharing all that. I think this book on Arthur will be timely in a lot of ways. And the book is The Unexpected President, The Life and Times of Chester A. Arthur. Scott, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. It was fun.
Well, thank you for listening to this episode. If you'd like to find out more about the book, more about Chester A. Arthur, more about just about anything you can think of when it comes to history, go to historyunpluggedpodcast.com. You can find past episodes, show notes for this episodes and others, and I will see you next time. Thanks for listening to the History Unplugged podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the show to get your daily dose of all things history related, from ancient Greece to the Cold War. You can do that by going to historyonthenet.com/subscribe. Speaking of History on the Net, if you want to dive deeper, go to our site historyonthenet.com, and there you'll find blog posts, book reviews, and all of our other podcast episodes. Plus, don't forget to rate and review this podcast so we can bring you the best daily history content possible. We'll see you next time at the History Unplugged podcast.